This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. 2 minutes and 40 seconds of lightning fast picking. Foggy Mountain Breakdown, written by Earl Scruggs, transformative piece of bluegrass music. It propelled the genre into the mainstream and inspired the next generation of artists to take up their own instruments. In his new book, Earl Scruggs and Foggy Mountain Breakdown, The Making of an American Classic, writer and longtime music journalist Thomas Goldsmith uses that song as an anchor point for exploring Earl Scruggs' legacy and the relationships that shaped his style. Tommy Goldsmith, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Great to be here, Frank.
Now, a lot has been written about Earl Scruggs, but you really spend time on that song and his style and kind of how it transformed the music. Tell us more about that.
My preference is to go really in-depth on subjects rather than portray some periods of people's careers that aren't as perhaps as interesting to me. So I'm always interested in how styles or careers come into being. I mean, here's Earl in Flint Hill, North Carolina, having a rough time as a family, but he comes up with a banjo style that propels him to the top of the country music business by the time he's 21 or 22, and subsequently to the top of the American pop music field, at least.
Tell us more about that style.
Well, it's built on a traditional picking style seen in the Piedmonts of North and South Carolina, in which the thumb plucks down and the first and second finger pluck up to create a pattern or roll, which was a little more primitive before Earl came along. It tended to stop and start. It didn't have that wonderful flow that you just heard in Foggy Mountain Breakdown. So Earl, according to the story he always told when he was 10 or 11, was able to transform the prevailing style into his own style, which was much more adaptable, much more flowing, fit right in the heart of what Bill Monroe was getting ready to do.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. Here's what he would have grown up hearing. I want to play a clip of this. Is Riley Baugus, of course. Music
great,
fans
yeah.
in North Carolina will know him and his great banjo style, but it goes back to what we would call that claw hammer style or an old-time style, and probably the kind of banjo that Earl would have grown up listening to. Let's listen to Riley. There's Riley. There he is, Undone in Sorrow, Riley Baugus, right?
Gorgeous, yeah, gorgeous playing, yeah.
It's beautiful stuff, and it's got that, he's using maybe two fingers, he's kind of pinching a little bit, a thumb and a finger.
Yeah, it's an interesting, it's sort of halfway between claw hammer and what would be called two finger, which there's some picking up. And, of course, that tempo is great. It's great for a certain kind of emotion and feeling. And story. And Earl, when he came along, was just ready to tell a different story. You know, it was right after when he emerged in public, it was right after World War II. Cars were moving fast. People were coming home from the war with lots of money. And there were developments in several fields of music, bebop, Rock and roll came a few years later.
Well, and isn't that what bluegrass, I mean, bluegrass really is a post-World War II phenomenon. As you say, things are accelerating.
Yeah.
So the blues becomes, goes on steroids and becomes rock and roll, right? Jazz becomes bebop, and country music becomes bluegrass. And again, everything's just accelerated in terms of tempo.
And it's so great. I think I cite this in the book, but there are recordings of Earl's playing with Bill Monroe on the Grand Ole Opry in 1945-46, and the people in the crowd are like, yeah! You know, they sound like a Carolina basketball crowd.
Yeah, but it's a rock band. Well, but that was it. It sped up, but it's tricky stuff. Let's talk a little bit more about this three-finger style now, because he's essentially taking these chords, and instead of doing one note at a time, as you heard Riley do so beautifully in that style, he's creating arpeggios, right? He's got these chords, but he's breaking them up. And every once in a while, he plucks that melody note, but not in the same place. So the pattern is off beat a little bit.
Right.
And he's messing with the tempo.
Basically, he's got a string of 16th notes going. But as you say, he can emphasize different ones of them. He uses his thumb for the melody a lot. He would say that the thumb's the strongest finger. That's what I'm going to do to... But then there are all these embellishments and adornments and, you know, crazy things he does up the neck, which of itself was pretty much of a departure. The what they call the classical banjoist would play in higher inversions on the neck, but not many country players use those positions. So,
we may have already answered this because things were changing in that post-war period and things were getting faster, but is that all that accounts for this? How much of that was Earl Scruggs and certainly his virtuosity had something to do with it, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, just the cleanness and I don't want to say perfection because everybody makes mistakes, but he had this wonderful drive and the ability to make each note rounded and full and expressive at these incredible tempos.
Right. You talk about 16th. So he's got 16 going to the measure, right? Well, I'm going to play a little bit of Foggy Mountain Breakdown again because there's another thing he does where it goes from staccato to roll. So you get this little cascade of notes. And I'm learning, you know, this is like the waterfall. It's like climbing up the waterfall one rock at a time and then sliding down. And he does it all in the course of this one song. Let's listen again now and start listening for that. Right?
Yeah, that's when he goes, I think that's the place where he goes to the E minor chord, which itself was very rarely used.
You don't play minor chords on a banjo,
no,
right?
No, well, it's like, that time.
It's like Steve, remember he used to say that, Steve Martin used to say you can't play a sad song on a banjo. That's it. Right?
Well, no one had done it before Earl, and then it became very common. But he goes, and that slows the roll down to kind of eighth notes for a few seconds. And that, I think that's the most recognizable thing about the song, aside from the tempo and just this great thrust that it has, is that minor chord. So you can pick it out from many other banjo tunes of roughly the same tempo or whatever.
Right, but it's unique. So talk about where he started with this and his playing with Bill Monroe and a little bit about the trajectory of his career with all this.
Well, I tell a story which has been much debated and followed about the song Bluegrass Breakdown, which is a composition that Earl says he wrote, but Bill recorded it. Bill Monroe, the founder of Bluegrass, recorded it under his name. And Earl said he thought that he would be getting credit for it, and in fact, it just appeared as Bill's song. And I said, well, did you argue with me? He said, no, I was the stupid one.
Had Bill Monroe, where was Bill Monroe in his career? Had he already become pretty big?
Yes, he was on the Grand Ole Opry starting in 1939. He had some hit records. He was recording music that was just right on the cusp, you know, just right under the surface of what would become bluegrass. Very fast tempos, fast mandolin playing, great fiddling. I mean, all the ingredients except one were there, and many people, I think, view banjo as the defining ingredient of bluegrass. Monroe vehemently debated that throughout his life.
Well, and he took full credit for this song, Bluegrass Breakdown.
Yep.
Bluegrass Breakdown, right. Bill Monroe, the Bluegrass Boys, featuring Lester Flatt, Earl Scruggs, Chubby Wise, and my guest is music journalist Thomas Goldsmith, talking about his book, Earl Scruggs and Foggy Mountain Breakdown, The Making of an American Classic. Tommy's going to read from the book on Saturday at 2 at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro, and then next week, Tuesday at 6 at Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville. Bill Monroe, as you say, that they disputed who, you know, the authorship of that one. Eventually, he will leave. Earl Scruggs leaves that band.
Right. Earl and Lester Flatt, the guitar player, were just worn out. I mean, they worked so much. And Earl said weeks would pass without their taking their shoes off. And he was upset with Monroe. And some of this in the book is new about... He said Monroe was unprofessional and didn't make it to gigs on time and all of that, which was not true in later years. He was, you know, very professional and upright. But they left. Both Earl came back to North Carolina, Lester to Tennessee. But very shortly, they talked on the phone and decided they were going to put something together and started the Foggy Mountain Boys. And it took them a few years, but not really too long, to create their own style, which included a lot of elements of what they had done in the Bluegrass Boys, but they quickly became a big act on their
own. And with help from another North Carolina great, Curly Seckler, right?
Yeah, Curly Seckler was in the band, Jim Shoemate, there was a bunch of them.
So they're on the road, and they were busy. They stayed awfully busy. I mean, complaining about Monroe, they were busy every day of the week.
They were, and the only thing was, though, the money was going into their pockets.
Doesn't make a difference. The banjo itself, in a lot of ways, Earl did for the banjo in white community, and this is very interesting to talk about the trajectory of the banjo, which becomes this country instrument. It is weaponized against African Americans in minstrelsy, and it becomes an instrument that becomes very difficult in a certain period of time for African-Americans to reclaim, and also difficult for white mountain folk because it had been so associated with hillbilly and backwardness, right?
Well, I mean, that's part of a whole big sociological shift when people no longer wanted to be considered hillbillies. Flatt and Scruggs certainly never wanted to be considered hillbillies. But yeah, the banjo, the akanting, as it was called when it came from Africa, is a remarkably similar instrument to particularly the five-string as played in old-timey styles. And except for, I'm sure you're familiar with Rhiannon Giddens and her whole crew, and they were really, I mean, just within, not only within our lifetimes, within, what, 15 years, they went to the Black Banjo Gathering, and all of a sudden there was this great kind of crossover of this music, which had extremely strong African-American roots back to contemporary African-American young musicians.
But those associations had kept people who had been, you know, very closely associated in white and black communities with the banjo from it because of the stereotyping. And Earl was concerned about that and in many ways resurrected that as a more respectable instrument.
Right. You know, I was thinking about this. I am sure there were lots of racist among bluegrass musicians, but they never came out against school integration or anything like that, as far as I'm aware. Monroe openly talked about his own debt to Arnold Schultz. You know, there was a lot of that. So,
yeah, my point here is that it was stereotyped and it was used against, in a sense, two separate communities, but all for the same reason, that it meant backwardness and poverty.
Absolutely.
And we don't want to ignore the contributions of people like Rhiannon Giddens, who also resurrected this, but he was somebody who was doing this as well when bluegrass music came out. So sort of pointing out that the twin strands of the same problem and the way it came together in the life and career of Earl Scruggs. The thing that really may have done it, because certainly Foggy Mountain Breakdown was a hit.
Right.
But it may not have been such a widespread hit.
No.
And then there was this, which he didn't write, but then it became well known.
Right.
I'm going to listen to a story about a man named Jed. A poor mountaineer barely kept his family fed. And then one day he was shooting at some food, and up through the ground come a bubbling crude. Oil, that is, black gold, Texas tea. Well, the first thing you know, old Jed's a millionaire. The kinfolk said, Jed, move away from there.
And all of a sudden, everybody was listening to the banjo and Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs.
Yes. I was amazed doing the research. I remember the Beverly Hillbillies, of course, but it was huge. It was number one show at a time when that really meant something, the number one broadcast show. They did hundreds of episodes, and Earl and Lester were to appear in a relatively dignified roles. I mean, they seemed a lot smarter than the Clampets, at least. And,
even Mr. Drysdale.
But Bela Fleck has always noted that was the song that got him. Many players, it was Foggy Mountain Breakdown, but Bela says he heard that and didn't know what it was, but he wanted to do that, and he wanted to learn to play that instrument.
Yeah, no, it really popularized it. And then, of course, the recontextualization of Foggy Mountain Breakdown in the movie Bonnie and Clyde. Talk about the importance of that.
Well, it according to my story, which is different from most of the versions that are out there, the two writers who were journalists at Esquire in New York City started working on the script or a treatment and listened to the original December 11th, 1949 recording of Foggy Mountain Breakdown the whole time. And then when they met with Francois Truffaut and these various people they wanted to get interested, they would bring along the record and play it for them. You know, Robert Benton, the guy that I mainly talked to, said that he knew that it wouldn't be, you know, in the movie. You don't decide on that when you're writing the script. But in fact, it held up, and D.D. Allen, the editor, who went on to become a famous woman in that field and just a great editor, apparently just kept turning it up. They had a whole score. This yeah. one of the great Hollywood writers had written, but said, "Now let's try this again." And it emerges as a motif that Robert Benton at least said was the voice of the movie. So I found that fascinating.
Well, how did it change? What were the trajectory of Earl Scruggs' career? Again, they've got a pretty giant silo that they're working in, this emerging class. I mean, country music is huge. It is the most successful, commercially successful music of the 50s. So he's fine there, but then he really breaks through.
Yeah, it came at a time when Flatt and Scruggs were accepted and appreciated on the hippie circuit. They played the Fillmore in San Francisco. They played the Miami Pop Festival. And when this song came out, it was everywhere. I mean, it was a hit in the way that songs are not particularly hits anymore, or very few are. So it became sort of inescapable to the degree that some bluegrass musicians didn't want to play it anymore. But Earl said he always played it. He's played it everywhere he went. And he almost kind of shrugged off the idea that it was only due to Bonnie and Clyde. He said, a lot of these kids weren't even born.
Oh, that was a hit in 49 when it was released.
Yeah.
So you got to know him a little bit and talk with him. What was he like? And what were some of your fondest memories and conversations?
He was just a wonderful guy. for someone so accomplished, he had very little ego. I mean, he would say, yeah, I could play pretty fast. Yeah, Earl. But I went over to the house a couple of times, and I should say I met him as a journalist. It was because of my vast skills as a musician, but I did go over and play with him a couple of times. And he and Louise would have these Christmas parties that my wife and I got on the list for, and you'd go over there, and there would be Vince Gill and John Hartford and Mack Wiseman and all these people just kind of milling around and then playing music.
Oh, wow.
And
wow.
There's a video that's up now. Somebody in Nashville shot at a party at Grandpa Jones's house, and everybody's playing Reuben, the tune that Earl came up with the roll on. So he's playing it. At one point, he looks over at somebody to take a solo, and it's me.
I just do. Yeah. Did you hit it, or did you just?
I did okay.
Way to go. Yeah. All right. Well, we got to check out that video and check out the book. Thomas Goldsmith, the author of Earl Scruggs and Foggy Mountain Breakdown, The Making of an American Classic. Tommy's going to be reading from that book Saturday at 2 at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro, and then Tuesday of next week at 6 at Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville. Tommy, what a pleasure. Thanks so much.
It's great to be here, Frank. Always good.
Coming up, an ode to okra. Oh, you got to hear that. Stay tuned.